In reaching its conclusion, the Commission explained away or ignored a number of inconsistencies and contradictions surrounding the crime. In other instances, it failed to follow up tantalizing leads. Because Oswald was dead and it was not a trial, none of the evidence was subjected to cross-examination, and thus, the entire inquiry and report was vulnerable to criticism from skeptics that would come later. The Warren Commission did not attribute a motive to Oswald's crime. It recounted his interest in communism and his attempt to defect to the Soviet Union in 1959, noting that he soon tired of life in the workers' paradise and asked to come home with his Russian bride Marina and their small child June nearly 3 years later. After engaging in a series of low-paying jobs in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Oswald moved to New Orleans in April 1963 and began engaging in some high-profile pro-Castro activities, getting arrested at one point after a scuffle with an anti-Castro activist. He attempted to establish a chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and sought publicity by engaging in a debate with Ed Butler, a local anti-communist activist, on a local radio station. Marina Oswald told the Warren Commission her husband sought public confrontation in New Orleans in hopes of getting arrested and getting into the papers. She said he believed the publicity would be useful to him when he tried to enter Cuba. The commission found that in September 1963, Oswald left New Orleans for Mexico City, where he was said to have applied unsuccessfully for a visa to enter Cuba and then travel on to the Soviet Union. The commission took note of this trip, but did not delve into the confusing set of circumstances surrounding one particular incident. These confusing circumstances came to light almost immediately after Oswald's arrest and before his murder. On November 23, 1963, in a recorded telephone conversation between President Johnson and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director revealed some startling information about Oswald's supposed visit to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. "We have up here the tape and photograph of the man who was at the Soviet embassy using Oswald's name," Hoover told Johnson. "The picture and the tape do not correspond to this man's, Oswald's, voice or appearance. In other words, it appears there is a second person who was at the Soviet embassy down there." From the start, the FBI concluded that there was someone in Mexico City impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald at the Soviet embassy. Who and why? Neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission seems to have been curious. Some Warren Commission skeptics have disputed that Oswald was even in Mexico City, but apparently he was. In his 1993 book, Passport to Assassination, Colonel Oleg Nekoporenko, then with the KGB, writes that he met with Oswald when the American visited the Soviet embassy in September 1963. He describes Oswald as nearly distraught, pleading to be allowed to travel to Cuba or the Soviet Union to escape political persecution by the FBI. He said that at one point, Oswald displayed a .38-caliber Smith & Wesson revolver, telling the Russians he carried it to protect himself from American intelligence agents who kept him under surveillance. While Nekoporenko is positive it was Oswald who visited the Soviet embassy on three occasions, it is odd that the CIA, which supposedly had him under its watchful eye, could not produce a photograph of Oswald entering or leaving the Soviet compound. The only photo it submitted as Oswald turned out to be someone else entirely. In its report, the Warren Commission found no credible evidence that any of the shots fired at President Kennedy's motorcade came from anywhere except the sixth-floor window of the Texas School Book Depository. It decided that the dozens of witnesses who thought shots came from behind the picket fence at the top of the grassy knoll were mistaken. It concluded that of the three shots fired, two hit the president and Governor Connally. To account for all of those wounds, one bullet had to pass through Kennedy's body and then strike Governor Connally. The commission said the bullet hit Kennedy in the back of the neck and exited his throat. That is the wound doctors and nurses at Parkland Hospital described as an entry wound, meaning it had to be fired from the front. The commission said the bullet then hit Governor Connally in the back, exiting his chest after breaking a rib, shattering his right wrist, then ricocheting into Connally's left thigh, where it lodged. Because one bullet missed the car and struck the curb, and one bullet delivered the fatal head wound to the president, the commission was left with no choice but to reach the conclusion it did. To do otherwise would be to acknowledge a fourth shot and the participation of another shooter. So assistant counsel to the Warren Commission, Arlen Specter, advanced what came to be known as the single bullet theory, or derisively as the magic bullet theory by Warren Commission critics. Specter argued that it was no theory but a fact. The bullet, he said, was on a trajectory that perfectly lined up with the wounds. Specter may have been wrong about the trajectory, but he was probably correct in his belief that one bullet wounded both the president and the governor. An examination of an enhanced close-up version of the Zapruder film suggests that is exactly what happened. In the film, Kennedy appears relaxed as he waves to a friendly crowd as the limousine disappears behind the Stemmons Freeway sign. We have no way of knowing what transpired in those brief seconds the car was out of view.